This is Tax Update for Saturday, June the 10th, 2006. Welcome to Tax Update for Saturday, June the 10th, 2006. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. This podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of this document. Such prohibited use would include using this podcast or document as part of a CPE presentation for which a fee is charged. This podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as an access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. This week, we're going to look at the IRS issuing of a headliner on their website just about a month ago that dealt with the issue of medical expenses, or more appropriately, medical insurance, paid for self-employed, or not really self-employed, but in this case, S-corporation shareholders, whose policies are written in the individual's name and not the corporation's name. This headliner came out to address the differences between the treatment of such an individual and a similar individual who was a sole proprietorship and did not have a corporate entity around them. This week we're going to discuss basically the way that ruling came down, what that ruling indicates, and also maybe some of the ways you get around that ruling and some of the items the ruling did not discuss. Well, basically, the issue is that the IRS headliner suggests that there is no coverage allowed or no allowable subtraction unless an insurance policy is issued in the name of the S corporation. Now, the ruling, as we'll discuss later in this headliner, and we probably shouldn't call it a ruling because it doesn't rise to that level. It's really more an informal discussion of the IRS posted on their own website. But this particular document suggests strongly that if you did not have a policy written in the corporate name, apparently you could never get a deduction under Section 162L. Now, Section 162L was a section added to the code a number of years ago that was meant to address the unfairness facing those who were self-employed and who were covered by medical insurance through their business compared to the position of those who are incorporated and had an insurance policy issued by their business. Now, as we're aware, Section 106 allows us a deduction on the corporate end for the amounts paid for medical insurance for our employees, but does not require those employees to pick that amount up in income if it is paid under a plan of the employer. However, that particular treatment was limited to employees, and the self-employed were left out in the cold. Well, Congress added Section 162L. 162L, which is what we're going to concentrate on in this podcast, deals with the special rules for the health insurance costs of self-employed individuals. And basically, it provides under Section 162L1A that in general, in the case of an individual who is an employee within the meaning of Section 401C1, there shall be allowed as a deduction under this section an amount equal to the applicable percentage of the amount paid during the taxable year for insurance which constitutes medical care for the taxpayer, his spouse, and his dependents. Now, that's a pretty broad discussion. And you notice nowhere in there did we find any discussion of any sort of plan or anything related to the business. So you may wonder, what's the issue? Well, when Congress went down and under L2A imposed a limitation, they also backdoor imposed a plan requirement. The limitation under the title of dollar amount says no deduction shall be allowed under paragraph 1, the one we just dealt with, to the extent the amount of such deduction exceeds the taxpayer's earned income within the meaning of Section 401C, that's a qualified plan provisions, derived by the taxpayer from the trade or business with respect to which the plan providing the medical care coverage is established. Well, there we finally find our little issue. We have actually now a question about where is the plan providing the medical care coverage. We must have a plan because we're going to need to tie that into the business, and we're going to have to make our measure based upon the business, and obviously the business has to be the one that's looking at for the plan. Now, there are various restrictions here for other coverage. You cannot be covered or eligible for coverage under your own employer's subsidized plan or that of your spouse, some other issues coordinating with the medical deduction, and then under 5, we have the treatment of certain S Corporation shareholders. And that notes under 5 that this section shall apply in the case of any individual treated as a partner under Section 1372A. Now, 1372 is a provision dealing with S Corporation greater than 2% shareholders, except that this provision goes on to note that for purposes of this section, such individual's wages as defined in Section 3121 from the S Corporation shall be treated as their earned income, and there may shall be such adjustments in the application of this subsection as the Secretary may by regulations prescribe. Now, that's important because remember, for the self-employed person, we're looking for wages under 401. For this purpose, we're not looking at the redefinition of wages, but we're looking at straight wages for this purpose. So basically, we have that particular issue to deal with when this particular clarification comes down. And note that it obviously does apply for S Corporation shareholders who would be eligible to pick up this deduction. Now, it's important to note Section 162L is a deduction provision. So basically, it says a 162L deduction will be available to S Corporation shareholders under these purposes. Now, 1372 probably needs to be reviewed very quickly so you can take a look and look back at that particular provision, the one that makes us very interested in greater than 2% S Corporation shareholders for a number of reasons, not the least of which is medical insurance coverage. 1372A provides for purpose of applying the provisions of this subtitle which relate to employee fringe benefits. The S Corporation shall be treated as a partnership, and any 2% shareholder of the S Corporation shall be treated as a partner of such partnership. Note that under 1372B, the 2% shareholder definition includes those individuals who hold 2% by attribution under Section 318. That means my spouse would count, even though if I was a sole proprietor, as we discussed in an earlier podcast, in a sole proprietorship arrangement, I could go ahead and hire my spouse and have my spouse receive the benefits or the fringe benefits that are denied to me as a partner or deemed partner of the S Corporation in this case, or as a sole proprietor, as we discussed earlier, because I'm not an employee, I can't get those benefits. However, as noted here, for an S Corporation, we still have to deal with Section 318, which causes us the problem of bringing in our close relatives, and they all count as 2% owners. Therefore, in an S Corporation, we have a lot broader swath of people who are affected by the provisions that disallow coverage. Now, the IRS on May 15th issued a headliner to clarify a problem, at least a problem that they saw. Late last year, there was a chief counsel advice, 2005-24001, that basically said if you're a self-employed individual sole proprietor, an individual policy can count as your plan policy for purposes of the self-employed health insurance deduction, and you could go ahead and get your deduction under Section 162L. Now, you know, basically, presuming we meet all the other requirements, that work. The question that arose was, well, what happens in the case of an S Corporation shareholder? And this headliner held, to quote, in contract, if the business is operating as an S Corporation, there is a different tax consequence if the individual who is a sole shareholder and sole employee purchases health insurance in his or her own name. Now we go on to the conclusion here. What does it say, and how does it arrive at it? Well, it reminds us that for fringe benefits paid by the S Corporation, there is a, basically, including health insurance premiums, Internal Revenue Code holds that the S Corporation will be treated as a partnership, and any shareholder owns more than 2%. Will be treated as a partner, and Revenue Ruling 9126 holds that accident health premiums paid by a partnership on behalf of a partner are guaranteed payments under Section 707C of the Code if the premiums are paid for services rendered in the capacity of a partner and to the extent the premiums are determined without regard to partnership income. As guaranteed payments, they are deductible under Section 162, subject to the capitalization rules of 263, and are includable in the recipient partner's gross income under Section 61. As such, it notes, the health insurance premiums paid by the S Corporation would not be deductible by the S Corporation as a fringe benefit, but would be deductible by the S Corporation as compensation paid to the 2% shareholder. The health insurance premiums paid by the S Corporation for a 2% shareholder would be included in the 2% shareholder's W-2. Section 162L5 holds that a 2% shareholder is treated as a partner under Section 1372. Or who is treated as a partner 1372 will be treated as a self-employed person, assuming all the provisions of 162L are met, may deduct the health insurance premiums paid by the S corporation as an above-the-line deduction. Now, quick caveat on drafting. If you go back 162L, it never made any statement about paid by the S corporation. But we'll leave that sloppy drafting for the moment of this statement. Now, it goes on to say there should be remembered that there are some limitations under IRC Section 162L2. The one that affects a 2% shareholder, the one that often affects 2% shareholder, deals with other coverage. Well, that's fine. We all know that if there are other coverage issues, whether you're an S corporation shareholder, partner, proprietor, you can't get the 162L deduction. That's not our problem. And it goes on to say, presuming, therefore, we have no other subsidized health plan, the problem arises if the sole shareholder employee purchases a health insurance in his or her own name instead of that of the S corporation. Aha, here's where we get to our issue. In that case, the S corporation has not established a plan to provide medical care coverage. Note that sentence because this will be crucial as we analyze this further and come down with, hopefully, a solution to the problem. It goes on to conclude there is no fringe benefit paid to the 2% shareholder. And the provisions of IRC Section 1372 do not come into play. Now that's important to note. The conclusion here is we do not have a fringe benefit. As such, we do not have a Section 1372 item. As such, since Section 162L required it to be a 1372 item, therefore, we do not have an issue that was going to get us a subtraction. As it goes on to note, since provisions of Section 1372 do not come into play, the S corporation is not treated as a partnership, and the shareholder is not treated as a partner. So we don't have that. Apparently, we're back to just being an employee. Since the shareholder is not treated as a partner, the shareholder is not treated as self-employed, is not eligible for the above-the-line deduction under Section 162L. Now, that's an interesting commentary, but there we go. That's our item. The shareholder is still able to deduct the health insurance as an itemized deduction, which is subject to the 7.5% AGI limitation. Now, that's the conclusion of this ruling. The ruling goes on to note that some states do not allow a corporation to purchase a group health plan with one participant, and essentially rules, well, tough luck, you're not going to get the deduction, even if that's the only reason why the corporation could not have the benefit. The state law, it note, does not override the requirement the S corporation must provide fringe benefits to its employees in order to have the 2% shareholder qualify for the Section 162L benefit. And goes on finally to conclude, in summary, contrary to the holding in CCA 2005-24001 dealing with sole proprietorship, a shareholder employee is not allowed to purchase health insurance in the shareholder's own name and still obtain the above-the-line deduction of Section 162L. Now, the key conclusion in all of that and what the thing based its conclusion on was that, in essence, if you purchase it in your own name, you have not established a plan. Therefore, there is no fringe benefit. Therefore, Section 1372 does not apply. Now, keep that one in the back of your mind. Section 1372 does not apply because that has consequences I don't believe the IRS would like to follow through on. But we'll keep reading. Now, essentially, as we noted, the limitations and why we have to have a plan was under Section 162L2 Cap A, where it gave us the dollar amount limitations. Now, so what is, though, a plan? If we look in the IRC, medical plans are referenced in Section 106. In fact, Section 106 was the section that we were trying to deal with, or Congress was trying to deal with, when they adopted Section 162L, because that was the unfairness here. In essence, with my C corporation, I could receive medical insurance premiums paid on my behalf, not include them in income, and still have my corporation take a deduction. But if I was a sole proprietor, I was out of luck. While I could pay medical insurance premiums, I got no benefit from them above the line. I had to take them below the line, and I had to take them subject to now a 7.5% of adjusted gross income limitation, which meant in many cases I got no benefit from the medical insurance premiums. So Congress, in trying to fix this, passed Section 162L that initially provided for a partial deduction for such premiums if you didn't have the otherwise disqualifying coverage, and has eventually expanded that to 100% deduction. So let's take a look, though, at Section 106A, since that seems to be the issue we were trying to deal with 162. And that provides, under 106A, except as otherwise provided in this section, gross income of an employee does not include employer-provided coverage under an accident or health plan. Okay, so there we have the little issue. If we have a plan, employees do not have to include it in income. Now, I will note in passing that 1372 never really defined fringe benefits, but clearly the presumption has always been that 1372 did apply, was looking exactly at these items like 106A, that were fringe benefits that were available only to employees and for which we did not redefine a self-employed person as being eligible to receive the benefit. Now, the question becomes, under Section 106A, what does the term plan mean? And under Regulation 1.106-1. Well, in 1961, and yes, that is 45 years ago, the IRS outlined Revenue Ruling 61-146, information about what might be considered a plan when the employer reimburses an employee or directly pays the premiums for an employee on an individually written plan. And the ruling goes on to note that basically advice has been requested about whether amounts paid by an employer under the circumstances below as his share of premiums for hospital and medical insurance employee are excludable from the gross income of the employees under Section 106 of the Internal Revenue Code. It looks like, I would say, as a fringe benefits, we'll put in parentheses, because it certainly seems to be that's what 1372 was aiming for. Now, the case in question, we're going to talk about individually written policies. The employee gets his own policy, covers himself. It's not issued under a group policy. In the case in question, the employer pays a share of the premiums for hospital and medical insurance for his employees. For those employees who are covered by the group policy through their employment, the employer pays his share of the premiums directly to the insurance companies. For those employees who are not covered by the group policy but have other types of hospital and medical insurance for which they pay the premiums directly to insurers, the employer pays a part of such premiums upon proof the insurance is enforced and is being paid for by the employees. Now, they come up with three methods that the employer may use in that case, could have used in that case, to basically accomplish this goal. Number one, the employer reimburses its employee directly once or twice a year for the employer's share of the premiums upon proof of prior payment of premiums by the employee. So the employee produces proof that they were billed for and paid premiums. They give that proof to the employer gives them a check for to cover those costs or cover a portion of those costs. Number two, the employer issues to each employee a company check payable to a particular employee's insurance company, the employee being obligated to turn over that check to the insurance company. That's number two. So I write the check as the employer to Blue Cross of Arizona, and the employee then delivers that check to Blue Cross to pay for their personal insurance premiums. Or number three, I issue a check in the same method as two, except the check is made payable jointly to the insurance company and the employee, so both Blue Cross and the employee. The IRS concludes under this ruling that in all three cases, you have a plan and you have an exclusion under Section 106 for payments under this plan. Basically, it comes down to a covered exclusion and an item that would not be part of income. Now, it's differentiated in a couple of cases that came later. We have a couple of rulings, in fact, three rulings that clarify this ruling down the line over the years. Revenue Ruling 75-241 that emphasizes you have to verify the payments are actually used for medical care. It's not enough to give an allowance equivalent and saying you're supposed to use this for medical care. Here's a $200 check, you know, now go do it. If the employer doesn't verify it, the employee could use it for personal purposes. It does not count. Revenue Ruling 85-44 similarly held that a former employee who received a lawsuit award, a portion of which was allocated to the amounts the employer should have paid toward group health insurance, could not exclude those amounts from income under 106 because the amounts were based upon what the employer would have paid, and there was no finding or no issue that the employee had actually paid for such insurance or that such items were there. It was based solely on the fact the employer would have had to pay that much, so therefore they were turned over to the employee as damages. And in Revenue Ruling 2002-3, the IRS refused to allow an exclusion from income for amounts an employer paid employees to make them whole after taxes for the reduction in their pay that had been applied, apparently across the board, to provide health care. I couldn't exclude that extra that basically I kind of knocked them down but tried to put them in the same after-tax position now. Now, you know, one of the key reasons why an employee can't be given an option to reduce their pay and then get reimbursed under an informal plan is that such a plan would fail to meet the requirements of Section 125 for a cafeteria plan, which is key. Now, as a complaint about the individual policy under the S Corporation was that the company did not have a plan, it would appear that if the company adopted, even for a single individual, a plan in accordance with Revenue Ruling 61-146, then the objection is avoided. So, despite the implication you might draw from this ruling, I would appear that if the analysis is, it would appear that even if their analysis is correct, you should be able to avoid the result. Why? Remember their ruling. There was no plan. The ruling 61-146 said the reimbursement constituted a plan. Secondly, let's even presume the IRS is right on this one. Let's accept that their ruling is one that we would allow and that basically we'll go along with and say the headliner is correct. If the headliner was correct, and if in fact this particular reimbursement arrangement was not a reimbursement arrangement that worked for these purposes, then the headliner had found it didn't work because it wasn't a fringe benefit. Take a look at Section 1372. Section 1372 only applies to fringe benefits. So Section 1372, if it's not a fringe benefit, then we don't do the reclassify this person as a partner and then treat them under partnership rules, but apparently we continue to treat them as what they are, an employee. So does that mean that if we reimburse under 61-146, and therefore we apparently don't have a fringe benefit, so we haven't triggered 1372, while we, true, would not get the deduction under Section 162L, maybe we don't care. Because what we would get is a deduction under 106A and an exclusion from income under 106A.
Note, I don't believe that is a position you're going to see sustained on exam. Rather, the IRS is going to argue that, in fact, you do have a fringe benefit plan here under Section 1372, and because you have a 1372 fringe benefit plan, we therefore have an exclusion. The exclusion from income is disallowed to the S Corporation. We have a fringe benefit, and now we're suddenly into this particular provision. Because let us remember, once 1372 applies, the logic of the headliner falls apart because it was predicated on the theory we had no fringe benefit, 1372 did not apply, and without 1372, you could not have 162L. Well, I would point out without 1372, you also don't lose the exclusion from income. So the IRS can't have it both ways. Either it can't be excluded from income, in which case, then we have a no problem, and I'm perfectly willing to give that up. Or it basically, if it can't be excluded from income, we had the fringe benefit plan. If it can be excluded from income, we don't care. We'll accept that any day, as opposed to giving up the opposite. But the background becomes what really ends up happening is that the IRS is going to argue 1372 applies. We go ahead and we get the deduction. Now, what does that mean you should do? Your clients need to do the following to make this happen. First, they really do need a written plan under Section 61-146. I would agree that if all they have done is personally pay medical insurance premiums and now they turn around and try to take the deduction under exam under Section 162L, the IRS probably will succeed because there does need to be some sort of plan. But a Revenue Ruling 61-146 plan that provides for reimbursement or the direct payment of the premium by the employer would qualify as a plan for purposes of 162L, or it certainly seems that it should. Remember, the IRS has not ever issued the regulations to tell us what 162L means. In fact, in many ways, we've not had any authoritative guidance. The closest we've had has been the Chief Counsel Memorandum, Chief Counsel Advice that we were discussing earlier. Not much is out there on 162L. Therefore, a reasonable position should prevail, and it certainly appears that interpreting plan the same way it's interpreted under the 106 section that 162 was supposed to relieve the unfairness of looks awfully reasonable at first glance. Second, it's important to understand that this teaches us a lot about how to interpret IRS sources. The level of authority granted by a document is important. Too many practitioners have treated this announcement as if it was on the same level as final regulations. It's not. It's about as far below that as you can get. In fact, it has about the same authoritative weight as this podcast does, which means it only works to the extent that you buy into the legal analysis, that the legal analysis itself is one that a court would agree with. I don't think this particular headliner is going to meet that test, at least applied anywhere out of the very narrow range of a taxpayer who only paid the premiums and did not have a 61-146 plan. It does not mean you never can make it work with individual policies. I happen to believe that unless the IRS removes 61-146 or basically pulls that ruling, that we clearly have the authority to go down this route for a plan. Finally, you do need to warn your clients probably that there is this headliner out there and that some IRS agents might attempt to use this position against them. I would tell the client that I believe, in fact, that position is not a valid one and that the IRS would not ultimately carry it, but we may have to push a ways before we're going to get the IRS to concede the position. The agent may take a while to get us to try to get us to get to accept that position. The agent may very well want to stick with it. So it is an issue that the client should be aware of on exam. But it does not mean if you're in one of those states the headliners mention where there is no way to get a group policy for the one entity that your client's stuck. It also doesn't mean if you have a client who doesn't want to move to what may be a very limited selection of group policies and wants to keep their coverage as is, that the client has to move in order to preserve the tax deduction. I think you can reasonably tell the client that we can adopt a 61-146 plan and certainly take a highly supported position that is deductible for tax purposes and that the 162L deduction is there and available. This has been the Tax Update for Saturday, June the 10th, 2006. The Tax Update podcast is a hopefully weekly presentation on tax matters that is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services. Reminder again, they're on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. We will continue to look at tax matters from time to time as they go forward. I'm going to be heading to Syracuse, New York here shortly, actually somewhat in a couple of weeks, doing a couple of presentations there for the New York Society, hopefully, that we'll be putting on at that point. And so if you're around that area, you may take a look at a couple of courses I'll have going on there. As well, we're going to be kind of keeping up on developments in the estate tax arena. As you're probably aware, this past week we had a vote, 57 votes for the permanent repeal vote moving forward. Unfortunately, that's 3 votes short of the total. But that also means now the Congress is going to be moving on most likely to some sort of compromise position, or at least there's lots of speculation they're going there. So we'll keep our eyes on what's going on, and there should be certainly enough developments over the summer to keep us busy. Again, thanks for listening to the Tax Update for June the 10th, 2006.